From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a new novel about secrets and deception by one of our foremost writers on the Vietnam War. We'll talk with Tim O'Brien about his experiences fighting the war and writing about the war. His new novel is called In the Lake of the Woods. Also today, gossip, power, and the culture of celebrity. We talk with Neil Gabler about his new biography of Walter Winchell, the gossip columnist who first reported on the private lives of politicians and celebrities. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Pentagon says a majority of Iraqi forces are beginning to move northwards away from the Kuwaiti border. But the Defense Department says U.S. troops will continue to move into the Gulf region. Officials say it's not known where the Iraqi troops may be going, and it will be several days before U.S. officials will be able to make sure that the entire force has moved away from the Kuwaiti border. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has condemned the recent terrorist acts by the Palestinian extremist group Hamas. It has kidnapped and threatened to kill a young Israeli soldier by Friday unless Israel releases 200 Palestinian prisoners. Christopher made the remarks today in Kuwait. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Kuwait City.
Having just been on a swing through the Middle East to promote peace, Warren Christopher was especially strong in his condemnation of Hamas kidnapping a young Israeli soldier.
I want to again express my outrage at the latest wave of Hamas terror. The promise of peace is very real. It's all more important that we not allow the enemies of peace to prevail.
The six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, expressed similar sentiments today. They praised Christopher's ongoing efforts to promote peace in the Middle East and declared their opposition to acts of terror that could disrupt the peace process. I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Kuwait City.
In Oklahoma City, the federal government has begun presenting its case against five Air Force officers involved in a friendly fire incident over northern Iraq. Natalie Bell reports from Oklahoma City.
This friendly fire hearing involves five Air Force officers, although two of them have waived their right to present evidence. A government witness testified today. He certified Air Force Major Lawrence Tracy for readiness to participate in airborne monitoring missions, even though Tracy had not completed the required training. Tracy was the commander in charge of monitoring the restricted airspace over northern Iraq when American pilots shot down two U.S. helicopters, which were carrying 26 people. Training has since been upgraded for airborne monitoring operations. Attorneys for the officers have contended in today's hearing. Upgrades have been needed for some time, and it took a tragedy to force change. For National Public Radio, I'm Natalie Bell in Oklahoma City.
U.S. officials say a charter plane is ready in Port-au-Prince to take former Haitian military leader Raoul Cedras into exile, but negotiations continue over his destination. A spokesman for the U.S. Embassy says Cedras will be gone before exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide returns to Haiti on Saturday. The spokesman says former Army Chief of Staff General Philippe Biambi will also leave with Cedras. On Wall Street, the Dow is up a point and a half at 3,878. This is NPR. The Nobel Prizes for Physics and Chemistry have been awarded. The physics recipients are American Clifford Shull and Canadian Bertram Brockhaus. They're credited with devising ways to probe atoms. Their method has been applied in many ways, from ceramic superconductors to exhaust cleaning systems in cars. Shull says their research was done 50 years ago. He's delighted, but he doesn't know why it took so long for his work to be recognized. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry has been awarded to George Ola of USC. He has been honored for his work in hydrocarbon research. A report released by a Senate committee today finds that much of the $25 billion the government spends on its computers is wasted on outmoded and inadequate systems. NPR's Melinda Penkava has more.
At a news conference, Senator Bill Cohen held up a vacuum tube, which he says the Federal Aviation Administration is still using in a mainframe computer that is a tenth as powerful as a personal computer. Outmoded computers in other agencies, says Cohen, cost the government billions in taxes not collected and health care fraud. The Maine Republican says the lag is largely caused by the government procurement maze, where companies that fail to win a bid can lodge lengthy protests. Some companies have worked out arrangements, which Cohen calls Fed mail.
Some of the contractors are even paying other contractors, paying them off not to protest the bid itself. So we've got a situation in which the procurement process is simply too long.
Cohen says he'll introduce legislation that would streamline the process. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington.
There are now 7 states affected by an outbreak of food poisoning traced to ice cream. Washington state authorities have reported a case of salmonella. Other affected states are Minnesota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Nebraska, Oregon, and Illinois. Officials believe the source is Schwan's ice cream, which is manufactured in Minnesota. Schwan has recalled the ice cream and moved production to Iowa. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 25 years ago, Tim O'Brien fought in Vietnam. Earlier this year, he returned there for the first time. He had already returned many times in his books. O'Brien is the author of several acclaimed war novels, including Going After Cacciato, which won a National Book Award, and The Things They Carried, which was recently described in the New York Times as one of the finest books, fact or fiction, written about the Vietnam War. O'Brien's new novel, In the Lake of the Woods, is set in the present, but it's haunted by the past. The main character, John Wade, has just lost a bid for the Senate because his opponent revealed that Wade participated in the My Lai massacre, in which a whole village was slaughtered by American soldiers. The revelation forces Wade to remember deeds he even kept secret from himself. I asked Tim O'Brien why he brought the My Lai massacre into his new novel.
Partly, I want to try to integrate the Vietnam experience into the larger experience of America and life as it's led after the war by my character John Wade. Secondly, I served as a soldier myself in the My Lai area about a year after the massacre occurred. I walked the same ground that Charlie Company had walked, including, you know, going through the village of My Lai 4, so it was called. The horror of the war, I suppose, was, at least in my own experience, was largely attached to that area around Pinkville, the area we called Pinkville, where the My Lai village is located. And 25 years later, that horror is still with me.
So you were in the area of My Lai about a year after the massacre. How do you think that the memories of the My Lai massacre affected the Vietnamese perceptions of you as an American soldier?
Oh, it was. We were despised. You could see the hostility. It was just shining or glowing out of the eyes of the Vietnamese in the villages in and around My Lai. We had no knowledge of the massacre, but we knew the place was just dreadful to operate in. We took casualty after casualty after casualty, landmines and snipers. The hostility was incredible, and when we found out about the massacre about halfway into my tour, suddenly things crystallized, and we realized why we were so hated in that area. Most places there was a kind of indifference, you know, that was you could detect in the eyes of the Vietnamese, but not so in the villages in and around My Lai 4.
Must have been quite an occasion for introspection about your own participation in the war.
Yeah, I mean, like my character in the book, I went to the war unwillingly. I went essentially for reasons of love. I didn't want to lose the respect of my hometown and my family and my country. And I suppose that that's a big part of why the My Lai incident takes part, you know, is embedded in this novel, that we as human beings do bad things oftentimes in the name of love or for love. My character certainly does, and I certainly did. I went to a war I thought was wrong, going essentially for reasons of love, odd as it may sound.
Well, you even said that, I don't know that you put it exactly this way, but your participation in the war to you now almost reads like an act of cowardice, because you went for love, and then you didn't want to fight, and you thought of going AWOL, and you didn't have the will to do it. You think in a way that if you were a stronger person, you would have found a way to get out.
That's right. I mean, these things are based, of course, on the beliefs one has. But if you believe, as I did, that the war in Vietnam was a ill-conceived war, your actions ought to somehow reflect your conscience, and mine didn't. I, as a 21, 22-year-old kid, couldn't summon up the courage to go to jail or go to Canada, whatever it would have taken to say no to that war. Instead, I was responding to that incredible love craving inside me. I just needed to be loved so badly by my hometown and country and family. And I think it was that force, at least in my case, but I think in a lot of other cases too, that pushed men into that war.
When did you start seeing it that way?
I saw it that way then.
Oh, really?
I've seen it that way my whole life, yeah.
There's a passage I'd like to have you read from your new novel, In the Lake of the Woods. And this is one of the kind of pivotal flashback sections in which your main character, John Wade, is remembering the massacre.
In the months and years ahead, John Wade would remember Thuan Yen the way chemical nightmares are remembered. Impossible combinations, impossible events. And over time, the impossibility itself would become the richest and deepest and most profound memory. This could not have happened, therefore it did not. Already he felt better. Tracer rounds corkscrewed through the glare, and people were dying in long, neat rows. The sunlight was in his blood. He would both remember and not remember a fleet human movement off to his left. He would not remember squealing. He would not remember raising his weapon, nor rolling away from the bamboo fence, but he would remember forever how he turned and shot down an old man with a wispy beard and wire glasses and what looked to be a rifle. It was not a rifle. It was a small wooden hoe. The hoe he would always remember. In the ordinary hours after the war, at the breakfast table or in the babble of some dreary statehouse hearing, John Wade would sometimes look up to see the wooden hoe spinning like a baton in the morning sunlight. He would see the old man shuffling past the bamboo fence, the skinny legs, the erect posture and the wire glasses, the hoe suddenly sailing up high and doing its quick twinkling spin and coming down uncaught.
Your character sees the old man with the hoe coming at him and thinks it's a rifle and shoots him. And even though he later realizes it was a hoe, he has to remember it as a man coming at him with a rifle. It's like the only way he's physically capable of...
Yeah, that plus a razor in general that, you know, when... And it happens in my own life that after 25 years, the human being survives, I think, after a horror like that through the quality of just erasing history, mm-hmm. trying to forget it, pushing it aside. And the events of 25 years ago come back to haunt me as they come back to haunt my character, only in little moments at night or while reading a newspaper or in dreams. And we reprocess the horror in little packets that then pop out and sometimes bite us, and oftentimes bite us very badly, as John Wade himself is bitten. He tries to hide his participation in the My Lai massacre from everybody, from his wife, and from he becomes a politician, and from the electorate. But you can't hide a thing like that forever, and you certainly can't hide it from yourself forever. And once the secrets of our lives are out, they can really hurt us, as I've learned myself.
How did you learn that?
Lots of different sorts of ways. One way is I've never been able to talk with anyone, and I've never written about some of the events that occurred during my own tour in Vietnam. But, you know, this book really has, in a way, has very little to do with Vietnam. It has to do with... I think of it mostly as a story about deceit and deception and guarding our pasts.
You know, as a writer, I'm surprised you're still able to keep secrets. You've written so much that's set in the war and that seems so personal. It's almost hard for me to imagine there's stuff you haven't told us yet, you know?
there's a private life a writer leads and a public life, mm-hmm. and the goal of my goal as a writer is to tell a tell a story, essentially, and then to give pleasure to readers and to try to make it into a kind of art, to salvage something out of all the wreckage that is my life, you know, the life of Vietnam, but the life afterward. And In the Lake of the Woods is meant to be an artifact that'll sit on a library shelf, and 150 years from now, some 19-year-old kid or some 40-year-old woman in Sioux City, Iowa, will pick it up and feel some, have the heart squeezed in good ways and disturbing ways and funny ways. And that's the purpose, I guess, of art, for me in any case, is to give pleasure to readers, to squeeze the heart, and to salvage something from the horror that was and is my life.
You still think of your life as a horror?
Yeah, I do. I wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine that was published in early October of 94. And though I don't get into any detail about my private life, the foundations that I thought were, you know, very secure in my life were suddenly pulled out from beneath me. This is 25 years after Vietnam. Going through a divorce that's just terrible. I'm living in limbo, essentially. I feel a little bit like John Wade at the end of my novel, this man whose marriage is not really collapsed, but sort of dissolved, sort of sailing away into the wilderness. And that's the feel I have in my own life.
You know, I read that New York Times article. I really liked it a lot. And In your article, you sound almost suicidally depressed. And I was thinking it almost seemed like too fresh a wound to be writing about. I think so often for writers who are writing about very personal things, particularly painful things, there's a little bit of distance between the awful event and the telling of the event. It seems like there's very little mm-hmm. distance in the case of this particular article.
Well, yeah, in a way that's true, but, you know, pain in life is always present, no matter, I mean, time has very little to do with it. That as a writer, I think I'm able to concentrate on, when I'm writing fiction, on story and on technical issues and on what it is that makes a reader turn a page, that kind of what next quality. I mean, In the Lake of the Woods is essentially a story about a missing person. And there, I had enough sense in writing the book to put my personal life aside and to write a story about what happened to this man's wife, and to keep us that sense of mystery alive. If I had simply fallen into a kind of a collage of self-pity and description of my own problems, that would have been one matter. But I've been writing for so long now that I think I'm able to, when I'm at the computer, separate life, as I'm leading it from the page, in a way. You know, I find refuge in the page. I find refuge in objectifying and turning, you know, a bad life into a good novel.
Something I learned about you in the article we're talking about is that you've been treated for depression for several years. Mm-hmm. And I kept wondering, you know, do you think that's something that's in your nature, or do you think of the depression as an after effect of the war? And is there any way of knowing?
Well, you know, I think depression is partly, you know, biological, it has to do with the chemistry of the brain. But I also have learned through all the years of dealing with it that it has to do also with history, the life of the child and the life of the young man and the life of the now middle-aged, you know, author. There's a mixture of chemistry and life. In my own case, as in the case of John Wade, I had a childhood and where I felt lonely and abandoned and chubby and friendless, just as my character does. And like my character, I turned to the hobby of magic. I remember visiting Lou Tannen's magic store in New York as maybe an 8-year-old kid and being so excited with my catalogs to buy tricks that I would then bring to my basement back in Minnesota and spend hours and hours just manipulating the world, making oranges turn into mice and making silk scarves vanish and things like this, where I felt a kind of control over the world, the way my character, John Wade, somehow finds a sense of security through doing tricks.
So you think that depression is partly in your nature, that you channeled
partly
it into
so.
Magic and stuff when you were young, and you always felt
then,
kind of isolated.
And then magic turns into story writing.
Right, right.
You know, where you can perform little miracles in your stories.
My guest is novelist Tim O'Brien. His new novel is called In the Lake of the Woods. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Tim O'Brien. This might sound dumb to you, and of course I was never in a war, but I've often thought, you know, that if you were fighting in a war and your life was on the line every day, if you'd be able to accept that someone in a comfortable home in a safe place could manage to be so miserable that they'd even think of taking their own life. And, you know, I guess I'm wondering if you ever thought it would, when you were fighting, if you ever thought that it would be possible to be so unhappy when you were safe?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one that has occurred to me very recently. Back 25 years ago, my main objective on this planet was to stay alive, to draw the next breath, to do anything for life, duck behind paddy dikes, anything to stay alive. And then 25 years later, I find myself alone looking at some yellow pills, wondering if I should swallow them or not. The two drives are so contradictory, so at such opposite extremes, that I wonder how I got from the point of a young man of 21 who just wants to live and nothing else to the point of a 48-year-old up at 4:30 in the morning, watching the clock, wondering if the phone might ring. Everything gone from his life, wondering whether to take those pills or not. Well, I'm beyond that now, but at the time, the mystery of how I got from where I was at one point to where I was at another point was confounding and will always remain a mystery to me in some ways.
Do you ever feel that you somehow, the war should leave you the kind of person who can always appreciate the small pleasures of life and never take anything for granted again, and so on?
No, I don't think so. You know, the human memory is short. Once, you know, it's even sitting here in the studio, it's hard to believe I even was in a war.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of the novel I wrote, and, you know, as much as we've talked about it, it's essentially is a love story. And the 25 years since Vietnam, I've lived as a person who's, you know, like John Wade, my character, whose interests are not in the past and not in Vietnam. They're shaped by it, but my interests are in having a good life, a happy life, trying to give, you know, write good books and so on. And Vietnam feels right now like ancient history. It's hard to see the connection, even though I know it's there.
Vietnam still doesn't seem to be over for you as a writer.
No, it's like blackness being over for Toni Morrison, or, you know, the kings being over for Shakespeare. It's just not over. How can it be? Life presents us with material, and I know I'm not really obsessed by Vietnam in any sense, but I find good stories in it. The story, I mean, if you think about it, you know, there are out there in the world, there are 115 human beings, or 110 or so, who took part in the My Lai massacre, and we know the names of 1, 2, 3, or 4 of them. The rest of them are still out there. What are they telling their children and wives and husbands and mothers and so on? What are they telling their friends? How much are they keeping secret? How are they tricking up their lives? And I'm mostly curious about what's going on in the present day world. I'm not too interested in Vietnam itself. I'm interested in what secrecy has, and deception and trickery, what that does to the human relationship, the human heart.
Do you find that depression is your muse or your enemy as a writer?
both. It is it's my enemy in the sense that when it gets to the point where I find myself standing and staring at a computer but not seeing words or not seeing images behind the words, it's an enemy. There are other times, though, in the writing of this book and in creating these characters where it's my best friend. I think every book, whether it's a comic book or a book full of tragedy and hurt, every great piece of art, I think, has its deepest roots in suffering of some sort or another. That's where humor comes from, and that's where the humorous episodes in this book come from, and also that's where the tragic elements come from. It has to do with the suffering of the human heart, the desire for happiness in the face of unhappiness. And so in that sense, depression is my friend.
Do you ever take medication for depression?
Oh, yeah. I'm loaded up right now. You should see my eyeballs. Yeah, I do. I've been on medications for years.
Does it affect your writing?
No, it doesn't seem to affect much of anything. I really don't notice much change. I think maybe in a way the stuff may be a bit overrated.
With the pills?
Yeah, it's a relative of Prozac I'm on. And it doesn't do much at all. Life itself has a much more impact. If I talk to a nice person, I feel nice. If I get a nasty phone call in the middle of the night, I feel nasty or hurt. And life itself is what is more important in terms of my register of being.
Was your trip earlier this year back to Vietnam your first trip back there?
Yes, it was.
Were you surprised by any of your reactions?
No, I can't say I was really surprised, Terry. I felt good when the trip was over. I felt a kind of, I can't say that the trip banished bad memories and bad images. It did not do that. But now, if I were to close my eyes, living alongside those bad images are very peaceful and very beautiful images. I'm remembering a particular rice paddy that 25 years ago was just boiling with machine gun fire and rocket-propelled grenades and amputations and death. And then if I close my eyes again, I'll see that same rice paddy as it is now, the sunlight gold on a water buffalo, a peasant walking across the paddy. So gorgeous and so serene and so ancient and so beautiful. Now at least there's some beauty to live alongside the horror. I'm very glad I made the trip.
Is that going to be helpful to you in the middle of the night sometime when you can't sleep?
Yeah, it already has been helpful. It already has been. I can feel it in my tone of voice. I'm not as frantic as I used to be. I've come to terms with a lot and don't even know how I did, except something changes inside the chemistry in my chest, and I feel a bit more peaceful.
Well, Tim O'Brien, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Tim O'Brien is the author of the new novel, In the Lake of the Woods. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the man who invented the modern gossip column and paved the way for today's celebrity-obsessed culture. We talk with Neil Gabler about his new biography of Walter Winchell. Winchell once said, "I don't make up nasty things to write about celebrities. I wait until they get locked up for taking dope or pimping. Then I make it public." Gossip, power, and the culture of celebrity, coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The State Department says Haitian military ruler Raoul Cedras is expected to leave Haiti for exile soon, despite last-minute problems. As Tomas Cabal reports, the U.S. has asked Panama to take him in.
Panama says that it will not consider granting political asylum to General Raoul Cedras and his family until a written request is received from Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, according to a spokesman for the Foreign Ministry. The spokesman explained that the negotiations are being carried out in an indirect manner with representatives of the Clinton administration and the State Department. The Panamanian government has been talking to diplomatic officials who in turn are in contact with President Aristide. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Cabal in Panama City.
The White House counsel is recommending no further action against Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy. He's being investigated for accepting gifts and favors from firms that his agency regulates. Espy announced earlier this month he'll resign at the end of the year, but he insists he's done nothing wrong. White House counsel Abner Mikva notes that Espy is quitting and that he's paying the government back for expenses. Mikva also says the Agriculture Department Inspector General should review the matter after an independent counsel finishes the probe to see if Espy owes more money to the department or others. Sections of the newly enacted crime bill are being implemented. The Justice Department has picked 300 communities to share in the first $200 million from the legislation. It will pay for new police officers to go on the street. President Clinton says the new officers are being paid for by money saved from a streamlining effort in the federal government.
The genius of this bill in the end may be that we really did say we're going to pay for this by shrinking the size of the federal government and giving every last dollar of the shrinkage to local communities to fight crime, to prove that they can bring the crime rate down. Not we in Washington, but you out there. This is a bill which gives you the power to take control of the destinies of your people. And I know that you will do it.
The officers must be used in community policing projects that improve ties between officers and civilians. A Denver judge has rejected a request by the city for an injunction to force striking teachers back to work. A teacher's walkout is in its third day. They left their jobs after rejecting a one-year contract written by the Colorado Labor Commissioner. A private business research group says most states are in their best financial shape since the mid-80s. The private conference board says states in the South and the Rocky Mountains are the most well-off. The board says tax revenues for fiscal 94 are equal to or higher than projections in all but seven states. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped a point and a half to end at 3,875. Declining issues led advances by a slim margin. This is NPR. A videotape released by the Muslim extremist group Hamas features a kidnapped Israeli soldier. Corporal Naxon Voxman says the Israeli government must free 200 Palestinian prisoners by Friday morning, or else he will be killed. A masked man is seen standing behind him holding an automatic weapon. The kidnapping has jeopardized relations between Israel and the Palestinian National Authority, which governs Gaza and Jericho on the West Bank. Israel says if PLO leader Yasser Arafat doesn't try to catch the kidnappers, he won't see expanded Palestinian rule in the West, or rather in the rest of the West Bank. This year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry goes to a Hungarian-born American now working at the University of Southern California. NPR's Joe Palka has more.
67-year-old George Ola won the Nobel Prize for his work with hydrocarbons. These are chemicals made up of carbon and hydrogen that are refined to make gasoline and plastics. In the 1960s, he helped discover a class of chemicals called superacids that helped in the oil refining process. Ultimately, Ola's work led to the production of cleaner-burning, higher-octane gasolines. It's also allowed researchers to liquefy coal. Ola is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and in 1989 he was named California Scientist of the Year. As the sole recipient of the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, he's the first Nobel Prize winner this year who doesn't have to share the 7 million Swedish kroner prize. That's worth about $950,000. This is Joe Palka in Washington.
The Nobel Prize in Physics has also been awarded. The recipients are Bertram Brockhaus of Canada and Clifford Shull of the United States. Both men were honored for developing new ways to scatter neutrons. This lets scientists look closely at solids and liquids. The method can be used in several ways, from looking at ceramic superconductors to exhaust cleaning systems in cars. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How did America become so obsessed with the private lives of celebrities? To get some clues, my guest Neil Gabler went back to the life of Walter Winchell, the reporter who invented the modern gossip column. Winchell became a celebrity by revealing the secrets of celebrities. In the late 30s and early 40s, his gossip column was syndicated in about 2,000 papers. In his radio broadcasts, Winchell reported a mix of gossip and news, all delivered in an urgent tone.
Now to the editorial room of the Jurgens Journal and Walter Winchell.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press. New York City. The Hudson River ice floes prevented the police launches from finding the body of the man who jumped from the George Washington Bridge a few hours ago. He was middle-aged and about 5'6". New York City. Attention, Hamilton, Ontario. Tragedy struck at the Fifth Avenue mansion of Dr. and Josephine Benedict Sharp today. The 27-year-old heiress to the Benedict typewriter fortune swallowed about 50 sleeping pills after a violent quarrel with her husband. Hollywood. The drummer in the Harry James Orchestra was arrested and charged with being a dope fiend today. He said the heroin he used cost him $450 an ounce. Morristown, New Jersey. Andrew Lord, a banker.
If you're too young to remember Winchell's broadcast, you may recognize his voice as the narrator on The Untouchables. Winchell left yet another legacy as a rabid red baiter in the McCarthy era. Neil Gabler is the author of the new book Walter Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity. Gabler is a former host of the PBS movie review show Sneak Previews and the author of a previous book about the early movie tycoons. I asked Gabler what kind of gossip Walter Winchell reported.
He reported on almost everything. He would report who was having an affair with whom, who was divorcing whom, who was having financial problems, who was consorting with gangsters, who was going to have a baby or who just had a baby, who was taking drugs. Almost nothing was off limits for him. And the revolutionary element of this was that prior to Winchell, if you were to report on a scandal in a mainstream newspaper, it was almost always the product of a court case, so that there was a court record that then entitled you to report on the court events. But when Winchell came along, he required no court record. He would print gossip as we know it, things that he'd heard, rumors that had been unverified.
He would sometimes use his column to be cruel and vindictive. I mean, you could quote his autobiography in which he said, I wait until I can catch an ingrate with his fly open, and then I take a picture. You botch me, I botch you.
That's vintage Winchell. I mean, that is vintage Winchell. There was an edge to his column and to his broadcast, and it was one of the things that made him popular, as it makes, you know, a Rush Limbaugh or a Howard Stern popular today. I mean, you'd listen to Winchell because all the rules of civility that had governed the media were also suddenly thrown off. So not only did he extend the purview of the media by moving into the world of privacy, but he also changed the terms in which those things were being expressed. I mean, that edge, that vindictiveness, that vituperation was something that, I mean, listeners and readers love that sort of thing.
How did he use his column to get even? What kind of slights would he take revenge against?
Well, I mean, they could be very, very small. Someone saying something about him that he didn't like. Someone on the wrong side of the political fence, that is the other side of the fence from Winchell. I mean, those sorts of things would drive him to distraction. But primarily it came down to whether you're on Winchell's side or not on Winchell's side. And anyone who said anything negative about Winchell was certain to receive the wrath of the column.
I guess the worst thing he could do to you is put you on his drop-dead list. What was the list?
The drop-dead list, or the DDL list, was the worst form of punishment for a press agent. Now, ultimately, most of these celebrities reached the column through press agents. And if it turned out that you had given Winchell a bum steer, or it turned out that you had given Winchell something that had been published in another column, or if you had boasted to people that you could get something into Winchell's column, I mean, there were a number of offenses, you would be placed on that DDL list, and which meant that he would not put any of your items into his column. Now, for a press agent who lived and died by Winchell's column, this was the very worst form of punishment because it could cost you your livelihood.
So, yeah, because Winchell was not only putting in the things you didn't want printed about your life, he was also putting in the things you wanted planted about
exactly.
yourself or your client.
Well, the idea was, you know, that no publicity is bad publicity, ultimately. I mean, that was an idea that took a while for the celebrities to realize, but it was one that they eventually came to accept. And the rule of thumb for Winchell was that you would give him five items about individuals who were not your clients, or five jokes that he used in the column. And for those, he would then repay you with one mention of one of your clients. So it was a kind of 5-to-1 ratio. That was the barter system in the column.
Now, what was it like for a press agent who gave an item to one of his competitors? Would he punish them for that?
No. I mean, Winchell would read his competitors. In fact, he would read his competitors aloud. Winchell loved to hold court. It was one of the things he loved doing most. He would read his competitors aloud, and he would say, well, I see that my rejects have wound up in these garbage cans. He was not a man of much generosity. In fact, I mean, one of the stories I love about Winchell is that he would read the proofs of an article or a column of someone who wasn't even famous, someone who was a very marginal journalistic figure, and he would then correct it and write on it and send it off to the writer, as if, you know, Winchell was everywhere. Winchell, there was nothing that was beneath Winchell's vigilance.
My guest is Neil Gabler, the author of a new book about Walter Winchell and the culture of celebrity. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Neil Gabler, the author of a new biography of Walter Winchell. Did Walter Winchell ruin any careers?
Well, the most obvious career that he ruined was Josephine Baker's. Josephine Baker came to the United States after many, many years in France and was performing first in Miami Beach and then in New York. And she ran afoul of Walter Winchell in a long series of events that began when she went to the Stork Club, which was Walter Winchell's hangout, and felt that they were taking an unconscionably long time to serve her. She thought that it was because she was black. She protested to the NAACP. They immediately sent pickets around the Stork Club, and they asked Walter Winchell, who, oddly enough, for people who know his later politics, was a strong advocate of civil rights, they asked Walter Winchell to condemn the racism at the Stork Club. Well, Winchell issued a blanket condemnation, but he didn't single out the Stork Club. And this disturbed the NAACP, who wanted Winchell to come down specifically against the Stork Club. Winchell felt that in doing so, he would be violating his friendship to Sherman Billingsley, who was the Stork Club's proprietor. And to make a long story short, he got into a battle with the NAACP and with Josephine Baker. He called Josephine Baker everything from a communist to a fascist, though he could never explain how she could be both simultaneously. But ultimately, by doing that, he drove Baker out of the country and destroyed her career here.
Did stars ever rebel against Winchell through, for instance, lawsuits?
Winchell always bragged that he had never lost a libel suit, but that was in fact not true. He did lose libel suits. In fact, he lost one in 1932. He was sued by the Fleetwood Beach Club. He had accused the beach club of being run by mobsters. He was angry at them because they had, he felt, through false pretenses, put his name on their board of governors. He was very angry. The Fleetwood Beach Club sued him, and he lost the suit. And he was asked to pay part of the damage. He was incensed that he would have to pay part of the judgment, and he went on strike. And at that time, he was working for The Mirror, which was a Hearst newspaper. One day, he walked into the store club, and this was all done in advance. They knew he was coming, and he got a phone call from William Randolph Hearst, who at that time was at San Simeon. And Hearst said, "Walter, you've got to come back to the paper. What can I do to placate you?" And Walter said, "The only thing you can do to placate me is to give me indemnification against libel." Hearst said, Winchell was important enough that Hearst said yes. So that even though Winchell was sued, he was never responsible for any libel judgment after that period, so that he could say whatever he wanted to say with impunity.
One of the things Winchell became famous for, besides his gossip column, was, of course, his radio broadcast, and we got a taste of his rat-a-tat style a little earlier. How did he develop that broadcasting persona?
That's a very interesting thing, because Winchell obviously was a print journalist. When he moved to radio, he had to develop for himself not only a persona, a radio persona, but also a radio format. He couldn't simply read the column on radio. He had to create something new. And he created what we now call infotainment. He would read the news in a highly dramatic style. He would, deliver gossip one moment and then a political editorial the next. And the effect was surrealistic. I mean, the commingling of 10,000 people have died in Ethiopia 1 second, and then the very next second, and Joan Crawford is getting a divorce from Francia Tone. I mean, those things juxtaposed had the oddest kind of effect on a listener, because it democratized everything. It democratized the greatest events and the most trivial events and put them at the same level. And it took Winchell a while to perfect that style. He began on the Lucky Strike Hour before he even had his own program, working to speed up his delivery in the belief that if you talked fast enough, there was not only a sense of urgency, but people wouldn't exactly know what you were saying.
That would be good?
And that would be good because most of the stuff he said was ephemeral and trivial. But if you read it with enough urgency, and if it raced by your ear quickly enough, you wouldn't know.
How did journalists in Winchell's time react to his blurring of the lines between news and entertainment?
Initially, Winchell was embraced, surprisingly, by the intellectual community, who found in him this strange, primitive novelty, this man who used language in extraordinary ways, who did things that no other journalist would do. And they found him to be, amusing and in some ways, important as a symbol of the popular culture. But after Roosevelt died, Winchell really lost his political bearings. And from a man who was a liberal and a populist in the 30s and through the war, he became a man who moved increasingly to the right, and in the process lost a good many of his allies and a good deal of his readership and listenership. So that journalists who were saying in the 20s and 30s that Walter Winchell had brought life and verve to journalism, that journalism had been gray and pallid before Winchell and was colorful and exciting after Winchell, were now saying that Winchell's unreason, Winchell's appeal to passion, that Winchell's power itself was dangerous and that it had a deleterious effect on the media. And that transition happened over roughly a 10 or 15-year period from the 30s to the post-war period, by which time many, many people felt that Walter Winchell was a very, very dangerous force in America.
Walter Winchell rewrote the rules for what it was permissible to report on. How do you think the rules have changed since Winchell's death?
The edge of the envelope keeps on being pushed and pushed and pushed. Even in Winchell's lifetime, it was pushed. There were certain things that Winchell would not talk about. For example, he wouldn't talk about homosexuality. He was very homophobic, but it just wasn't something that he generally included in his column. But by the 1950s, once Winchell had loosed the gossip, over that 20-year period from the late 20s, early 30s to the early 50s, there were other vehicles that had come along that had moved far beyond what Winchell was doing. Confidential magazine, for example, which would report on the sexual practices of almost any movie star. And homosexuality was not off limits for Confidential magazine. And I think one can trace from Winchell through Confidential magazine to People magazine or any of the tabloids, the supermarket tabloids today, or not even the supermarket tabloids, but the so-called mainstream tabloids, just the expansion of the kinds of things that a journalist feels he's entitled to write about. And there is almost nothing today that's off limits.
I think one of the differences in Winchell's day, Winchell might have reported on some of this stuff, but there weren't, you know, talk shows in which celebrities would voluntarily go on themselves and offer dark secrets to the public.
Well, that happened by the late 50s. And Winchell himself recognized what a great change this was going to affect in the column. When he was the only one dispensing this material, it was one thing. And it gave him a monopoly of, as we've already said, extraordinary proportions. But when celebrities themselves realized that they could avoid the middleman, they could go to television directly or they could go to a journalist directly and they could tell their own stories, that really had an enormous impact on Winchell personally. I think it helped rob the column of its immediacy and its importance.
My guest is Neil Gabler, the author of a new biography of Walter Winchell. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Well, tension seems to be easing in the Persian Gulf. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Mary Kay Magstad will report from Kuwait City on developments there. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has been visiting Kuwait. He says there are signs of Iraqi troop movements going to the north, going back further into Iraq. Nora Bustani, The Washington Post, tells Robert Siegel about the lack of support this time among some of the Gulf states for the Iraqi action that has been threatening Kuwait. Joe Palka reports on the Nobel Prize winners for chemistry and for physics announced today. And there's a new anti-cursing law about to go into effect in a small town in New Jersey.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Neil Gabler, author of a new book about Walter Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity. You write that Walter Winchell understood the bitter subtext of gossip. It wasn't just voyeurism. It was a weapon of empowerment for the readers and listeners. How so?
Well, you have to understand that what we have to look at what gossip does. And what gossip does is it rips down the wall between us and them. It shows us them, and by that, of course, I mean, you know, celebrities, in their least admirable characteristics. And this is something that I think we can't stress enough, is how powerful that idea is, that celebrities are no better than we are. In point of fact, they may be worse. That we know more about them than they know about us. That we have a kind of superiority. I mean, that is a very important subtext of gossip in my estimation, and it's one that Walter Winchell understood, which is why his gossip usually had that nasty edge, that little diggy edge to it. He didn't only tweak celebrities. He liked to really twist the knife in them. And I think he did that, again, because he understood that gossip is a populist form.
Do you think celebrity journalism goes too far now? Does a lot of celebrity journalism disturb you?
I don't. Celebrity journalism doesn't disturb me if it's segregated to its proper place. I think the real problem, and this is a problem that Walter Winchell did not have, although he was in part responsible for introducing the problem to us, is that in Walter Winchell's day, there was a strict segregation between the tabloids and the respectable press. No one would have ever confused the New York World or the Herald Tribune or the New York Times with Winchell's Mirror or the Graphic or the Daily News. These were distinct entities doing distinct things and purveying distinct cosmologies about how the world operated. But through the years, over the decades, we have seen a convergence that the respectable press and the tabloid press come closer and closer and closer and closer. And today, celebrity journalism is not segregated to the tabloids or to celebrity magazines. Celebrity journalism is everywhere.
I guess one of the things I worry about is that I think we're ruining a lot of really good talent by creating celebrities who cease to become real to us. I mean, I think at a certain level of celebrity in America, you are so hounded by the press and by photographers who are laying in wait for you that it starts to deform your character. And I think a lot of talented people start to lose their talent because it's just impossible to keep your bearings once you're in that high celebrity world.
Well, certainly, I mean, this book of Walter Winchell is a cautionary tale about that very thing, about a man who became his persona, and then when and performed in this show that was his life, and then when the show closed, he was still in costume, but there was no place for him to go. Today, I think what's interesting is that celebrities, and to take the situation that you've just described, celebrities make their lives into their art, so that their lives are parallel to the movies they make. Demi Moore may be on the cover of Vanity Fair making a career out of having a baby, even when she doesn't have a film in circulation. And that is a form of entertainment. The life itself becomes a form of entertainment for our edification. We want to read about these celebrities, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and these ongoing sagas. I mean, Elizabeth Taylor is another example of that. The woman hasn't made a movie in years and years and years, unless you include the Flintstone cameo. But she can get on the cover of People magazine anytime she wants because her life is the entertainment. Her life is the movie.
Well, Neil Gabler, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Neil Gabler is the author of a new biography of Walter Winchell.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, winds up another Jurgen's Journal until next Sunday night at the very same time. Until then, and with lotions of love, I remain your New York correspondent, Walter Winchell, who can remember all the way back when Time magazine, which knowingly employed ex-communists as senior editors, was famous for its red cover instead of its red face. Good night.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave, research assistants from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at what's happened this week in the Persian Gulf and why. We talk with journalist Fred Halliday, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.